Belt and Commonwealth. And don't forget your laptop.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Catherine Smith, representing Sound Belt Northwest. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This is a second appeal arising from a 2008 settlement agreement that itself arises from an earlier appeal in 2007. Judge Sindler, I see that you and I are the only people who have had the privilege of being on all these cases.
I think Judge Becker was on one of them.
Judge Becker was on the last one, yes.
Yeah. I went back and reread the old, Judge Ellington wrote one.
Judge Ellington wrote one. Yeah. Judge, I don't know what that says about us. We should be considering retirement, but at any rate, I don't think it's dispositive. This case, these parties entered into an agreement in July 2008 after this court had affirmed a specific performance of a contract that had actually been individuals who Commonwealth had provided title insurance to had actually sold the property to another developer. And so Commonwealth was looking at a situation in which 22 homeowners were going to be evicted because they had insured title and taken an indemnification from the developers. So that was their impetus for entering into this agreement. They agreed to pay $5 million immediately and to make a second $3 million payment once a final non-appealable order was entered against their indemnitory. Now, leaving aside the fact that saying final non-appealable in the same sentence sort of makes my eyelids twitch, everybody knew what they intended here, and that was that they were going to be able to get a judgment against Newhall. There was no requirement that the judgment be enforceable. There was no requirement of anything except that there be this final judgment entered. And what happened after that was that Commonwealth basically took a dive on the appeal that was brought by Newhall of that. And after they did, the Sound Belt made arrangements to go to the trustee of Newhall in bankruptcy.
When you say they took a dive, are you referring to the three-month delay in the correspondence?
Well, in fact, it amounted to a two-year delay because they did nothing to try to get this resolved until after the case had been fully briefed, and then they did nothing to prevent Newhall from going into bankruptcy or to keep this case going at the appellate court level. And their argument was,
well, did they have an obligation contractually to stop Newhall from going into bankruptcy?
I think they had an obligation to not take the position in that appeal that they were going to lose the appeal. And that was essentially the argument that they were making to the bankruptcy trustee, is that, well, wait a minute, we might lose this appeal. Don't allow the trustee to sell this claim. And that was what they did, and that was a violation of the agreement. Both the time is of the essence agreement and their obligation to get a final non-appealable judgment against Newhall, even if it wasn't enforceable, as soon as reasonably possible. And there was simply no way that a court under the circumstances or a jury could have found, given the facts that were testified to by the parties to this agreement, that was not a material breach of this agreement. And that's essentially our case here, that Commonwealth had an obligation to get a judgment. It didn't have.
So the evidence didn't support the jury's finding because of the testimony at trial.
That's correct. I mean, this is a substantial evidence appeal. Now, there is a question here. I think procedurally the case is difficult because when the case was remanded the second time, the remand was for trial or other proceedings consistent with this opinion, the dreaded consistent with this opinion.
Right.
So Judge McDermott.
I didn't know that was dreaded. I always thought that was great.
Well,
lots,
I think
options.
It gives it. Well, Judge McDermott thought that the fact that trial was also indicated there meant that he couldn't consider this case on summary judgment once the record had been developed. And I think that that's important for this reason. When the second appeal, this is the appeal that both Judge Becker and Judge Schindler were on, came up before this court, procedurally, the action had been brought. It was a CR 2A enforcement provision essentially in the underlying action, the action against Day Allen. And there was a question, and this is dropped in a footnote in that case, that essentially that it's questionable whether Soundville could have done this because they weren't even a party at that point. And then there's this characterization of it as summary judgment. But Commonwealth's real argument was, wait, we need to be able to put in our affirmative defenses. We can start a new action. They got to do all that. And at the end of the day, the facts in this case, as testified to at the jury, were ones that essentially there was no justification for what Commonwealth did in this case. And I think we talk in our brief about the fact, I think we can see why the jury might have done that, and it was because over objection, Commonwealth's counsel asserted this idea of lost profits into the case in the closing argument. Of course, the parties had agreed that if there was liability on the merits, the amount of damages had been established by this agreement.
I wonder if you could just, in the remaining seconds here, just spell out the alternative world that could have unspooled if everything had gone the way you think it should have in terms of what Soundbuilt should have done as opposed to what they did do.
At what point, I guess?
If from the beginning. I mean, you said that this is a substantial evidence case. There's just no way, no justification. I'm sorry, not Soundbuilt, Commonwealth.
Commonwealth should have paid the money once there was a final judgment because they got a chance to dispute this in litigation in the bankruptcy court. And instead, what they did is delay payment under the provisions of the agreement. There was no there was no requirement that the judgment against Newhall be litigated in the appellate court to finality. The dismissal supported payment under the agreement. And I think it's unfortunate because of the way that the case went up initially, and the fact that it was brought as a CR2A initially, caused the case not to be resolved on a summary judgment. But that doesn't eliminate the fact that there was, that once the evidence came in, there was insufficient evidence to justify a decision for Commonwealth under the terms of the agreement and the party's intent.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Paul Lawrence for Commonwealth. As we understand, this is a sufficiency of the evidence claim, but one where Soundbuilt is really re-arguing their closing argument and asking this court to substitute its review of the evidence for that the jury made in rendering its verdict. And that, of course, is not the proper role of the court.
No, but we still have to look at the evidence. So
you absolutely have to look at the evidence.
So the argument is there's no evidence to support the jury's finding related to Commonwealth, as I understand it, that it was a non-material breach.
Well, and let me address the specific evidence that supports that finding, but I also think it's important to emphasize first the standard of review because that's totally glossed over.
Well, we know what that is, so
okay.
You probably don't need to spend time on that. But I think the thrust of the argument today is focusing on what happened in the bankruptcy court.
Sure.
And whether...
Why wasn't that material on the part of Commonwealth?
Well, first of all, the materiality is a question of fact that appropriately should go to the jury. It is decided the jury had the law of the case, which was the jury instructions. There's been no error assigned to any of the instructions that went to the jury. There's been no error assigned to the failure to grant summary judgment. So what we have under Washburn, this court's decision Washburn, is the law of this case is the jury instructions that the jury had in front of it. And those jury instructions set forth a standard for materiality, which then was argued by both sides. In this particular case, the sufficiency of the evidence regarding the lack of materiality is based on the particular breach that was found by the jury. Now, again, if you go back and look at the record and what you heard it again today, Soundbuilt argued was that the breach occurred back in February of 2009 when this thing went into bankruptcy, mm-hmm. and when Commonwealth failed to immediately take steps to get the stay release so that the appeal could thing.
Well,
that's not what the jury found.
Taking a dive on the appeal. So
there's no evidence about taking a dive. This is a manifestation of an argument. But Chris Brain, who was testified, said, "Look, I don't lose cases. We did everything we could to win that case. It was a fully briefed appeal." It was appealed and argued before this court. There is nothing that was raised about the briefing in that appeal or the arguments that were made to suggest that anyone was taking a dive. The briefing that was made and the arguments were made were for Commonwealth to win that appeal, which was their obligation under the agreement.
Was there any way that appeal was going to come out in such a way that it was either either a clear win, not a clear win, or a clear loss? Because, I mean, that seems
yes.
to be one of the
yes.
things, was that maybe it could have come out in such a way that, you know, there would be a judgment, but not the whole judgment.
First of all, there's several pieces of evidence on that. I think you start with the fact that the trustee was under no obligation to pursue the appeal. The trustee had to make an independent determination based on the bankruptcy law and the interests of the estate whether or not the appeal had merit
right.
in order to spend money on it. The trustee determined that the appeal did have merit and that it would likely result in a reduction at least of the amount of the claim that Commonwealth had against the estate. So he decided to pursue the appeal and spend money on the appeal. There was testimony presented at in the course of the bankruptcy proceeding and also reiterated at trial here that the attorney for the trustee thought that the most likely result of the appeal would have been either a remand or a substantial reduction of the claim from $3 million. We also had testimony from Chris Brain that there were essentially three potential results that he thought would come from the appeal. One, it could be upheld, in which case $3 million would be due. It could be reduced to the amount of the original insurance policy that was indemnified, which would have made only $830,000 due. Or there were arguments also that the indemnity was not effective so that no additional money would be due. So again, there was evidence presented in our trial by Chris Brain that demonstrated three potential outcomes, including one that would have reduced the obligation
all, nothing
to zero.
Partial.
Exactly.
Okay. And so, and there was also testimony from the bankruptcy lawyer
yes.
about what he did or didn't do related to any delay.
Then you're talking about the bankruptcy lawyer for Commonwealth.
Cullen.
Yes,
yeah.
Jack Cullen. And this goes to what the jury actually found. So there was testimony about what Cullen did when he was retained, what in his course is the normal practice of A, trying to figure out the estate, whether there's anything worth pursuing against all the new all. It led to his conversation having the bankruptcy converted to a Chapter 7, which meant that a new trustee was appointed who was in charge. He testified that, as is typical, and this was consistent with the testimony of the trustee as well, that there's a period of time that the trustee needs to assess the entirety of the estate. The trustee testified it was a complex estate. It was not a typical asset estate, and that took time. And this all led up to now between February of 2009 to July of 2010, where finally the trustee is ready to address this asset, the appeal, and there are discussions between the parties about whether or not there can be some deal that can be arrived at among all three, that is the trustee, Commonwealth, and Soundbill, to resolve. And essentially, Soundbill at that point writes to Cullen and says, look, okay, we come July, this has been a long time, you're verging, he doesn't say you have breached, said we're verging on a brief, and at this point it's time to either let's come to a deal or move forward with your appeal. And Jack Cullen, that was on July 6th, Jack Cullen wrote back on July 13th of 2010 and said, my client has decided to move forward with the appeal. Now, he testified that he was busy, and it took him 3 months. He didn't start on that immediately. And that is the date, July 13th, the date that Mr. Cullen wrote back saying we were going to move forward with the appeal, that the jury found a breach. But the breach, as what the evidence showed and what Judge McDermott noted afterwards in the post-trial briefings, was that delay in not immediately starting to file for relief from stay so that the appeal could go forward and waiting 3 months. So the question about the evidence about why it's sufficient to say that's not material is, one, it was a short delay in performance. It was not a significant delay. Two, there was no argument, nor could there be, that there was any obligation to pay triggered during that three-month period. We all understood, and in fact, jury instruction 11 made clear that there was no obligation to pay until there had been a final non-appealable order. And there was no way to get a final non-appealable order within those 3 months. In fact, if we look at what happened with the appeal itself, 3 months later, in October, the motion for relief from stay was filed. And remember, the trustee said, I'm not going to just agree to this. Go ahead and make a motion. So it wasn't even that easy step. The appeal was then briefed and argued. And as of February of 2012, and this is now almost, you know, more than a year and a half later, that appeal is still pending before this court awaiting a decision when the trustee's settlement is appealed. So there's no way that 3 month delay could have caused any sort of significance. It wasn't material. I mean, the evidence was that it wasn't material. It was argued both sides on that point, and I think the jury appropriately found that was not a material breach of the obligations.
Maybe you're the wrong person to be asking this, but I'm. What was Soundbelt's explanation as to why they abruptly moved at that point? Why not just wait? I mean, we don't take forever to issue our opinions.
Well, there was testimony by Paul Brain, who in this case was representing Soundbelt, that they were worried about the results of the appeal. And there was an email that was sent to the trustee saying, we need to get this deal done and approved by the court before there's a decision by the Court of Appeals, implying that the Court of Appeals decision could screw up the deal. Might have completely reversed, in which case, you know, then there was nothing. Nobody would collect anything. That is, neither the trustee nor Soundbelt would have been able to collect anything, because the payment that Soundbelt promised to the trustee was totally premised on it being paid by Commonwealth. So the evidence, and so sufficiently of the evidence cave, where you have to take everything in favor of Commonwealth, all the inferences in favor of Commonwealth, clearly supported the notion of the jury that a short delay in the performance of moving for relief from stay from July to October was not a material breach of the agreement. You have asked the question about that, and I only have 20 seconds left, so we're going to rest on our brief that there was also more than sufficient evidence to demonstrate that entering into the trustee's agreement in violation of the negotiations of the settlement agreement, the terms of the settlement agreement, and then the email from Mr. Karush that clearly stated the understanding that only a situation where all parties agree could there be a settlement with the trustees, and we would ask that you deny the appeal. Thank you.
I think it's important to get the undisputed facts about the procedure of this.
Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Oh, no, I get 13 minutes?
I did four.
Wow.
No, I just missed that one.
Well, yeah. I don't think I have that much to say.
We'd be here all day.
The trustee initiated settlement discussions in this case shortly after this bankruptcy was commenced in February 2009. I mean, we're not talking about a 3 month. I mean, yes, that's when the jury said there was a breach. But the fact of the matter is that Commonwealth had been not doing anything with this case for over 18 months when the things finally came to a head while it was in bankruptcy. They were doing nothing, and we kept saying, what are you going to do? And they're not doing anything, because the longer it lasts, the longer they're not going to have to pay their money.
So was that evidence presented to the jury that they weren't doing anything?
They weren't doing anything.
And so what evidence was there before the jury about what they should have been doing?
Well, I mean, the evidence was that this agreement required them to as soon as reasonably possible, get this final non-appealable judgment entered. And,
well,
you know, there's
it was all briefed and
it was all brief. It was and, all and but
and
it wasn't
argued. And somebody was writing an opinion.
And it wasn't.
And all of a sudden, you know, everything comes to an end. I don't understand why that isn't kind of dispositive.
In what way?
In the sense that, you know, Commonwealth, at least if the argument that Mr. Lawrence just got through making is rooted in fact, which I'm going to assume it is, based on the testimony of the witnesses, that the jury was confronted with a situation where, you know, the appellate decision could have gone three different ways, all right? So that just as it's about to come out, Soundbelt, which if the appeal comes out in favor of Soundbelt, you know, you're going to get paid, right? But instead, you just stopped the whole process for $225,000.
Soundbelt was not a party to the appeal that Dale Allen had brought against Commonwealth.
But you got the trustee to drop it.
And to the extent the Commonwealth was entitled to credit for that, then they can get credit against their $3 million for the $225,000 that was paid.
Well, it seems isn't it fair to say that, you know, Soundbelt's concern is it wanted to get $3 million, not nothing?
Well, yeah, and that was what they were entitled to under the terms of their agreement, because
not,
there was a judgment.
Not if the final judgment came out nothing, right?
But what you're being told here, though, what you were told here, and there's one at least one inaccuracy and factually, Mr. Lawrence has said that, well, this payment was, at least this is what I understood him to say, this payment depended upon us getting the money from Newhall. And that's not true. That's the reason that this was litigated in bankruptcy court. And there is no way that any rational trier of fact could think that Commonwealth going into the bankruptcy court and saying, well, don't take this deal. I understand, trustee, that's what you think this claim against Newhall is worth, but don't take this deal because we might lose. How is that not a breach, a material breach of their obligation to, as soon as reasonably possible, get a determination that Newhall owes them $3 million, and they've already got a judgment for that. They guessed wrong on whether this agreement with Newhall was going to be enforceable to the tune of $3 million, and that's not a reason not to pay Soundbelt, because their right to the $3 million under this agreement was not dependent upon Commonwealth getting it from Newhall.
Okay, but it still isn't. I mean, in other words, a lot of time has gone by in this litigation. Okay,
yes.
So now you've got a case, you've got an opinion just about to come out from the Court of Appeals. Okay, and all of a sudden, you just step in and stop it. When, you know, if what you're saying is true, that you would have gotten paid the same amount anyway, well, then why not just wait for that opinion?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't, perhaps this court knows that there was an opinion about to come out, but the parties didn't know that. I mean, nobody said, next Monday, here it's going to be. There's just no determination of that. And even if that were the case, Commonwealth had an obligation to pursue this matter to a final judgment, and they didn't do it. And Soundbelt, under those circumstances, curing their failure to do that, did not breach the agreement.
Let me just ask you one more question, because you started out your argument and opening here with the phrase, they took a dive on the appeal, and I'm still not quite sure what you meant to convey by making that remark.
The fact that they went into the bankruptcy court and said, look, we might lose. I mean, they were basically saying at that point, we are going to lose, and that's the reason you shouldn't allow this claim to be purchased. I mean, they said, we're going to lose.
All right. Thank you very much.